Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. Yep. Welcome to ITE 1, Module 5, Part B, or Part 2. We sort of did talk about the beginnings of installing, or the installation process of installing operating systems last week. So to kick off the lecture today, we will start with the last week's quiz. So we, as we always do, we will go over the quiz that we had last week, just to start and ease you all into this subject. Okay, so again, if you can write your answers into the chat window, and we will begin now. So, okay, question one, which three common tasks are performed during preventative maintenance? A, now we have to choose three, check and secure any loose cables, B, update the RAM, C, clean the mouse and keyboard, D, update the drivers, E, reinstall the operating system, and F, install additional peripherals. Go now. Yeah, three options. They were A, check and secure loose cables, B, update the RAM, C, clean the mouse and keyboard, D, update the drivers, E, reinstall the operating system, or F, install additional peripherals. And the correct answers go to A, which was check and secure the loose cables, C, clean the mouse and keyboard, and D, update the drivers. Okay, most of you got some or all of that. Okay, question two. In which two situations is it recommended to ask the customer to sign a liability release form before attempting any kind of repair? Remembering we want to. A, the technician needs to share the responsibility with the customer. B, the information on the computer is critical. C, the technician is unable to back up the customer information. D, the information in the backup is confidential. And E, the customer is unable to provide a backup. Go now.
G, A and B. All options.
Okay. All right, so the correct answers were C and E, for those that got that right. It was the technician, you would do it in, if the technician is unable to back up the customer information, or E, if the customer is unable to provide a backup.
Okay, now just to clarify that question, am I looping again or am I fine?
You're looping still.
Somebody is reflecting my audio back at me. We need to find out who that is at some point. I don't know who it'll be. But it's not. It's not happening in the lobby. And Gemma and I've just tested it, so we'll just have to deal for the moment.
They're running Sappy, whoever they are.
That's interesting. Lisa had it
though. Yes, okay. One, two. How's that? Alright, we'll sort that out after lecture. But the key point of that is that it's a legal responsibility, and that's what that question is dealing with, what you're going to be legally liable and responsible for. You're doing most of the talking anyway, so you can be on AutoVox, and then if I need to say something significant, just toggle that off at some point. Yeah, I'm picking up from the microphone that's just behind me.
We can also hear Geraldine just coming through faintly.
Okay, question three. What is the first step? I'll try and say that again. The first step in the troubleshooting process. A, gather data from the computer. B, gather data from the customer. C, verify the obvious issues. Or E, evaluate the problem and implement the solution. E, close with the customer, or F, try quick solutions. Go now.
B, B. Bing, 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 bing.
Excellent, excellent.
We've all answered. The answer was B.
The answer was B, and that was gather the data from the customer. Customer's going to give you the obvious issues that they're confronting, which is going to then lead you into the next steps after that. So, you know, find out what's been happening from the customer first. Okay? All right. Question four. Which type of question allows the customer to completely describe the problem? Is it A, close-ended, B, open-ended, C, specific, or D, technical? Go now. Look at all go, that's great. I think just about everybody got that question, which was, it is an open-ended question.
Yeah.
Okay, not everybody's having a go at these quizzes. They are for your benefit, not for ours. They are. So have a go. Look, you know, we're not going to rack your knuckles if you're wrong.
Well, Lisa's on the Mac, she'll have trouble getting at the chat window. For anybody else.
Yeah, voiceover is being a beep.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, it's pretty standard. Anybody else, please try and answer your quiz questions. You're the ones that are going to fail the exams if you don't. So open that chat window and try answering the questions. I know it's hard to remember which one's A, B, C, D, or E, but do give it a shot because it's good practice for the multiple choice tests that you're sitting at the end of each module. So, yeah, we'd really like to see everybody answering those questions.
And the trick is to, when you hear the option that you think is right, remember that option if you can. Yeah, good on you. Okay.
Yeah, if you hear the option, type in the letter that you think it is, wait until Geraldine's finished, and then press return. So that's easy. You just go, I heard the right one, C. And then you wait, and then when she's finished, rabbiting on, you press enter, and you've answered the question. So, easy done.
It'd be really handy if you actually went through the options twice.
We wouldn't have enough lecture time, I'm afraid, George. We're really pressed for time. We've got a lot to get through. If you're having trouble with your Ventrilo, get a set of headphones. Unless you're running on speakers, wind the old volume up. It's pretty clear on the recordings. If we went through the quiz answers twice, it would make the quiz twice as long, and we would actually cut into the lecture time, which is a bit of a problem.
And we do have two quizzes too. We have one at the beginning, which is the one, I know, George, you haven't been involved.
To eliminate the wrong ones as well.
So I think that you'll find that, you know, we have the one at the beginning, one at the end, and then each week we get the one that was at the end at the beginning of the next week. So it's just a sort of revision. So most people have actually been through this one before too. Okay, question five. What is the last step in the troubleshooting process? A, gather data from the computer. B, gather data from the customer. C, evaluate the problem and implement the solution. D, close with the customer. Or E, try quick solutions. Go now.
D,
okay, the correct answer was D, and that was to close with the customer. Finalise, and as you said, Elise, last week, I think, was don't forget your invoice.
Yes, exactly. I was wondering if anyone would remember.
Oh, I remember. Memory like an elephant. No comment, everyone.
Let's hope that's not the only thing that's like an elephant.
I was trying to get in before you. Yeah, just a short one. Yeah. Okay. So, as I said, last week we were talking about how to prepare for an installation of an operating system, and today we're going to be talking a bit about different types of installations and different file systems used in the computer. So, a clean installation of an operating system, it proceeds as if the disk was brand new, so you're not actually attempting to preserve any information that's on the hard drive. So the first phase, and we talked a little bit about last week, was the installation of the installation was partitioning and formatting the hard drive, and that included preparing the disk, or that involves preparing the disk drive to accept the particular file system that you are about to install. As I mentioned last week, the file system provides the directory or structure, and it organises the operating system of the particular user. With regard to Windows XP, and we are sort of mainly talking about that at the moment, it has two file systems. Does anyone out there know what those two file systems are?
InterFS and FAT.
Yeah, look at them go. Excellent, that's great. Okay, that's great. Okay, well, I can go now, you've all know it. Okay, but we'll go through it. So, in the file allocation table, we have 32-bit, or FAT32, and that's a... And that's a file system that supports partition sizes of up to 2 terabytes. Anyone know what a terabyte is?
1024 GB, as it seems.
Excellent. That's great. So 2 terabytes would be 2048 gigabytes. Okay. The FAT32 file system is supported by Windows 9X, also by Windows ME 2000 and Windows XP. Anyone tell me what NTFS stands for?
New Technology File System.
That's it. Thanks, Elise. And that can support partition size of up to 16x bits. New Technology File System is the correct terminology. And it's actually a system that has more file system security features. So it has an extension of the attributes of the FAT file system. So when you begin installing Windows XP, you would get a wizard that comes up, like a lot of installations, and a few of you will probably have seen those wizards that appear. The next, everybody hits. Please read those wizards, because it's very easy to hit next and suddenly you've installed something you didn't want. Okay. Everybody familiar with the wizards that you see come up?
Don't forget the unattended install disk as well.
Yes, not by Southeasting.
Okay. All right. Okay, so you'll get the option to install using a typical setting. Typical basically means the same as the default settings. And the other option you'll get is a custom setting, installing using a custom setting. That's where you want to customize it a little bit more, so you use a custom setting. Okay. If in general, using the typical sitting is probably going to be your easiest way to do things, particularly until you're more familiar with options that you want. Okay, during the setup of the installation, you'll get things like things that will be put in will be that you'll need to put in was name and the company, product keys, types of things like that, the administrator password. So you can set all those up, using different commands. So when you have the computer boot up with the Windows installation CD, you'll find that XP will just automatically start, and it will give you three options, basically. There's Setup XP, and that allows you to run the setup and install the operating system. You will also get Repair XP, which allows you, as it sounds, to repair the installation. And to do that, you would press R during the installation to open your recovery console. And to quit the setup without installing Windows XP, you would press F3. Okay. So to create accounts, you find that the administrator account is automatically created when you install XP. And as a default setting, the administrator account defaults to the word administrator. So my suggestion to you is that after you've logged in, is to change that password as quickly as you can.
Have the right to change password.
Yes, that's right. So, yeah, and you know, change that password as quickly as you can. So, otherwise,
actually, hang on a sec. I've got to interject here. The other thing you also want to change. I just step back in the room here for 5 seconds, and I've already got something to say. You should change the name of the administrator account. You should change it to something else. Because a lot of the attacks on your Windows box rely on the administrator account being called administrator. So don't call it that. So change that after you've installed it. The other thing I was going to point out here, and Geraldine's quite judiciously given you all the keys you can press, R to run the recovery console, F3 to exit the install, all those sorts of things. I would also like to point out that all of this is written on the screen. If you read, it's all there in front of you. If somebody is reading to you, they can read you those keystrokes. And it's very important that when you're installing an operating system, that you pay attention to what is on the screen. And that should have underlines and italics and everything. Pay attention to what the computer is telling you. Too many installs have been mucked up by administrators who pressed a whole lot of buttons and just didn't quite pay attention to what they were doing.
Your voice echoing.
Yeah, I know the voice is echoing. We can't do anything about that. There you go. Back to you, Georgia.
Thanks, Kerry. Okay. So, yeah.
I'm not brave to install.
No, but you will be. Otherwise, you will find that you will be installing things in ITE 2, and you will be installing them onto virtual machines. And it doesn't matter how brave you are or not, if you want to pass, you'll need to be installing things in the practical test. So that's something to gear yourself up for.
Okay. You'll also get the opportunity during your installation to create user accounts. And you can create them pretty much at any time. So it's got a user account actually has fewer permissions than that what the administrator. Obviously, you know, the administrator is the big boss, so if you think of it that way, and they have more ability to change things and administer the account, hence their name. And the user has less rights, and that the administrator can actually set the rights that user has as well. So that after your Windows installation has started, it copies all the necessary operating files to the hard drive, and then you'll find that the computer will reboot and it'll prompt you to log in for your first time. You will then need to register your copy of Windows XP, and it'll also prompt you to do a verification of the operating system to make sure that you have a legal copy of Windows XP. And by having a legal copy, it's going to allow you to keep up to date with patches that come out. You'll be able to download those and also service pack, new service packs as they come out.
Has anybody heard of Genuine Product Advantage?
Yep.
That will cause your computer to start nagging you if you have an illegal copy, and you will not be able to download certain updates and patches, and you will get notifications in your system tray, and that is not very pleasant at all.
Okay, so when those new patches or new service packs come out, you'll get prompted, and you'll have to be on the internet obviously to download them, and then you will download them, and there's usually lots of things that happen in it. You get security fixes and other updates that occur, so they're good to keep up to date with those patches as they come out. So
my computer downloads automatically.
Yeah, that's one of the options you can have, and is to download automatically.
Not a good idea.
No,
because if you download automatically and there's a bad update in the patch cycle, you're done for. You really should watch out for what patches are going to do, because some of the patches will break your computer. And I've had a lot of people have problems with patches, breaking their movie encoding software, breaking their multimedia playback. In fact, there's some really nasty patches that cause... There was one that broke my sound card, and that was not fun. So download automatically is not cool. You should really look at what you're installing, but it's your computer, so you do what you want, but automatic download is a bit dangerous. Do you trust Microsoft? I don't.
I know Kerry and I both don't have automatic updates on ours. Download automatically.
I don't.
It's better to know what you're downloading. And it does ask you if you're ready to download it, and you can make the decision yes or no then. Okay, you also need to verify that all of your hardware has been installed correctly. And a way you do that is to use the Device Manager, and that helps you to locate any problems that you may have had during the installation.
No, I wouldn't do that either. I would ask before you download them. If you download automatically and choose whether you're going to install them, you could waste a lot of bandwidth on something you don't intend to install. So ask me would be the better option there.
Now, could anyone tell me how you get to the Device Manager using Windows?
You can do it by going to My Computer Properties.
My Computer.
Yes, that's one way.
Control Panel.
Yes, you can go through Control Panel.
Anybody know the two quick ways?
Yeah, there is a quick...
Windows Accessible.
You can press Windows Pause Break, Windows Pause Break, and then press Control Tab to get to the Hardware Tab, and then Tab and then Spacebar to get to the Device Manager. Or you can type Start Run, and you can type in devmgmt.msc in the Run dialog box, and that is referred to in a lot of Knowledge Base articles, so they're the quick ways to get into the Device Manager. Or you can make a shortcut on your desktop.
Yes, so watch this space for all the latest shortcuts. Thanks, Kerry. Okay, so when you're in the Device Manager, if you... now, you will get the questions on this. I think I might have touched on it briefly last week. You will get a warning icon that comes up, and it has a yellow exclamation point or a red X. If you've got a yellow exclamation point, it represents the problem with the actual device, okay? And if you wanted to view the problem description, you would right-click the device and then select Properties. If you have a red X, it represents a device that has been disabled. If you wanted to enable the device, you'd right-click the disabled device and select Enable. If you have a category that hasn't been expanded, there is a plus or minus sign next to them. You would click on the plus sign. Now, I know you're all going to say yes, but we can't see the yellow and we can't see the red, but you need to know what those things stand for in the exam.
Also, okay? if you are fixing a computer for a sighted person, you must know what colour and what type of icons, because they will tell you red exclamation mark, yellow X, which would be wrong, of course, because it's a yellow exclamation mark and a red X. You need to know what colour they are for when somebody tells you what is on the screen.
Okay, so, and you will, I can guarantee you get a question on those in your exam. Okay, you have been warned. Okay, so when you've got a Windows actually detecting errors, you get a dialog box that comes up and it says, do you wish to report this error? Yes or no, basically. If you select to send the report, then Microsoft will get error reporting called Microsoft Windows Error Reporting, or WER, and that actually collects information about that particular application and any of the modules involved that have caused the error, and it then sends that information off to Microsoft. Okay, all right.
Why is redundancy error?
Don't understand the question.
You can expand.
Redundancy error in what context, Samuel? Redundancy error in floppy disks, RAID arrays, hardware configuration. There's a lot of things that have redundancy.
Double copying.
That means your source disk is corrupt. It cannot read the source file. You've tried to copy something off a corrupted CD, or a flaky or bad or misbehaving hard drive, or a floppy drive. A cyclic redundancy check error, which is the full name for the error, and it's very important that you must teach your users this to give you the full error, not just a couple of words. Otherwise, it's very hard to diagnose what the error actually is. But you've tried to copy stuff from a corrupt floppy or a failing hard disk.
Okay, thanks, Kerry. Okay, we've talked about sort of installing on one single computer, but if you've got multiple computers, as you would have in a corporate type environment, and you want to install the multiple operating systems, you can use something called Microsoft System Preparation, or SysPrep. And that's a tool that lets you install and configure the same operating system on multiple computers. And it actually prepares the operating system that you're going to use on the computers, and it has prepares them with different hardware configurations. And you're able to then quickly install the operating system. It also completes the last configuration steps for the operating system setup and installs the applications. Okay, we're going to move on now to disk cloning. It actually, when you have cloning, as like in people, I guess, or animals, as they've been doing, you're creating a mirror image. So disk cloning actually creates an image of a hard drive that's in the computer. Okay, there is a step by step on that in your notes, I'd like to refer you to have a read on how you actually go through that step by step. Okay, after you've installed your Windows XP, the computer is going to go on to the next step of booting it up. So you would firstly turn on your computer. And when we turn on the computer for the first time, or when we turn on our computers using the start button, we call that a something boot. Can anyone tell me what that is? I'll give you a hint. It's either a warm or a hard boot. Warm or cold boot is what, you know, well, it's cold boot in this case, or a hard boot. That's right. Okay. And if we're talking warm, a lot of people say soft boot as well. So, yeah, that's great. And then the computer would perform POST. Okay, everyone, what does POST stand for?
Power on self test.
Excellent, look at them go. Wonderful. Okay. POST, and you will get questions on POST
power
too.
Power on self test.
Excellent. Okay, at that stage your video adapter won't have been initialized, so any errors that you get at that time in the boot process will be reported to you by a series of audible tones or beep codes. We did talk about in the last couple of weeks about the differing beep codes and what the different beeps mean. After POST, you'll find the BIOS locates and reads the configuration settings, and they are stored in the CMOS. Can you tell me what CMOS stands for?
You want to say that one, not type it into chat.
Yeah, just say it. Complimentary something?
It is a battery.
No, yes. CMOS is not a battery. Absolutely not. CMOS is not a battery.
Can anyone remember what it stood for? Oh, did you, Gemma? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Complementary metal oxide semiconductor.
Excellent. Okay, Gemma and Dean get a gold star.
The key to CMOS is that CMOS is battery backed. That is to say that the battery helps the CMOS memory retain its information, and it keeps the real time clock running. Otherwise, your computer would forget what time it was. And the IBM PCXT had no internal clock on the system board, which is why original versions of MS-DOS ask for the date and time every time you turn on the computer, and in the absence of an autoexec.bat.
Okay. Okay, so the configuration settings are stored in the CMOS, and the configuration setting is the order in which the devices will be tried to see if an operating system is located there. Okay, so then the BIOS boots the computer using the first drive that contains an operating system, and once the drives is located, BIOS locates the master boot record, or the MBR. Then the master boot record locates the operating system bootloader, and for Windows XP, for example, the bootloader is called NTLoader, or NTLDR. Going to get lots of abbreviations coming up in IT. As I mentioned at the beginning, it's a good idea to make yourself like a little index of all of these, so you've got a quick reference to see what they all refer to. Okay, so at that point, the NTLDR goes on to controlling some more steps in the installation. If there's more than one operating system present on the disk, the boot.ini gives the user or yourself a chance to select which one to use. If there's no other operating systems or you haven't made a selection quick enough, you'll find that NTLDR will run, and ntdetect.com and that gives you information about the installed hardware. Now, these steps are good to refer back to, but I'll just go through them quickly with you. You'll find that NTLDR then uses the path specified in the boot.ini file to find the boot partition. Then the NTLDR loads the two files that make up the core of XP, which is NTOSKRL.exe and HAL.dll files. Then NTLDR reads the registry files, chooses a particular hardware profile, and then goes on to load the device drivers. Okay, that's a lot to take in on a... Okay, Windows Registry. In the Windows Registry, the files are there. They're an important part of your XP boot process, and they are all have sort of distinctive names. Now, you will get questions on these names in your exams, and they begin with H key, followed by the name of the portion of the operating system that's under their control. So all of the setting, or all of your settings in Windows, are stored in the registry. Okay, you can make changes to the control panel settings, also your file associations and such, and also your installed software, but all the changes are then stored in the registry. And each time you, each process that you use has a unique section in the registry. With Windows, the login process pulls system settings from the registry to reconfigure the system to the state that it was in the last time that you turned it on. And at that point, your NT kernel takes over, and the name of the file there is the ntoskrnl.exe. Okay, and it starts with a login file, and we call that winlogon.exe, .exe just meaning an executable file. And if you've got a SCSI drive that'll boot your computer, Windows will then copy the ntbootdd.sys file during the installation. And if the file, that file won't be copied if the SCSI drives are not being used. So to take you through a quick synopsis of that, your boot sequence for XP is the power on self test or POST, then POST for each adapter card that has a BIOS, then BIOS reads your master boot record, master boot record then takes over control of the boot process and starts NTLDR, then NTLDR reads the boot .ini file to show which operating system to load and where to find the operating system on the boot partition. Then NTLDR uses ntdetect.com to detect any installed hardware. And it then loads the ntoskrnl.exe file and the hal.dll file. Then NTLDR reads the registry files and loads the device drivers. Then ntoskrnl.exe starts the winlogon.exe program, and then it displays your Windows logon screen and you break out the champagne. Okay, so there's a lot in there, and I would advise you to try and make yourself familiar with that process of what it goes through. Okay, after you've installed your Windows XP, if you want to make some changes to your configuration, there's a number of post-installation modifications that you can use. One is msconfig, M-S-C-O-N-F-I-G, and that's a boot configuration utility, and it lets you set the programs that will run at startup and also to edit the configuration files. It gives you a fairly simplified way of controlling Windows services. Another one is Regedit, R-E-G-E-D-I-T, and that, as it sounds, allows you to edit the registry. Regedit 32 was used with Windows NT, but in Windows XP and Windows Server 2003, the regedit 32 file is a shortcut to the regedit.exe command. In XP you can either have or enter in regedit32.exe or regedit.exe, and they'll both take you to the same program. Beware though, if you're trying to edit the registry, you can create problems for yourself. You may end up having to reinstall from start. Okay, there is a number of modes that are used in Windows, and if you press F8 during the boot process, it will open the Windows Advanced Startup Options menu, and that's going to let you select how you want to boot Windows. And there's a couple of modes that will come up. You'll have an option to go into safe mode, and I don't know whether anyone's used. I'm sure there are some people that have used safe mode. When you actually use safe mode, it starts Windows, but it only loads the drivers for the very basic components, such as things like the keyboard and your display. You can have...
Jaws talking in safe mode.
No, it will not. Jaws will not talk in safe mode.
You can choose the option of safe mode with networking support, and that gives you Windows... it starts at the same as safe mode, but it also loads the drivers for the network components. You can also go to safe mode with the command prompt, and that starts Windows and it loads the command prompt instead of the GUI. Remember what our GUI stands for, folks? GUI?
Graphical
yes, we got an answer
interface.
Here. Excellent, that's right. Okay. I'm just bringing these up. I know you all know them, but it's great to sort of put them well and truly into your brain. So, okay, there is another option there too, which is the last known good configuration. Now, that's a very handy one I've found in the past. And it allows you to load the configuration settings of Windows that will use the last time that you had a successful startup. And it does that by accessing a copy of the registry that was created, okay? And it is, it's not useful, though, unless it's applied immediately after you've had a failure. So if the computer had been restarted and it managed to open Windows, the registry key for the last known good configuration will probably be updated with faulty information. So beware, it may not work. Okay. Sorry, what was that? Not sure. We didn't hear that question, sorry. Okay, yeah. Okay. All right, now we're going to go on to file extensions and different file attributes. In Windows, files are organized in a directory structure. So the root level of the Windows partition is usually labeled as something drive. Anyone tell me?
C.
Thank you. Excellent.
That's the hard disk that it's on, but that's not the root of the file system. The root of the file system is C:\.
Yes. Oh, sure. Yeah, I've assumed that too. Yep. Okay. There are an initial set of standardized directories, which we call folders for the operating system, and there's also for the applications, and gives you your configuration information and your data files, and you can install most applications and data in whatever directory that you would prefer them, but there is a structure that's usually followed. Okay, when you have files in the directory structure that they adhere to a Windows naming convention, so they need to have a maximum of 255 characters. The characters such as period or backslash or forward slash are not allowed in your Windows naming convention. Your extension of 3 to 4 letters is added to the file name, and that helps you identify the type of file it is. And file names are not case sensitive. Okay, now I'm just going to go through, I'm going to give you some file extensions. This is just to see if you know them. And can you tell me what they expand to or what they mean? If you had a .doc file, it's used in a particular format.
Microsoft Word.
Document.
Yeah, Microsoft Word, that's right. Excellent. What about a .txt files? What does that mean?
Notepad.
Text file. .txt, it will default open with Notepad, but they are text files. We don't want the program that opens them. We want the type of file. So it's a text file. But yeah, we know Notepad will usually open text files by default, but there are other programs that can open text files as well. So if you've got one of those in, it'll open them instead.
Okay, that's good. .jpg. It's something format.
Image.
Yeah, graphics, image, basically. Image. Yeah, yeah.
Technically, it's JPEG. Which is the expansion of JPEG.
Picture file.
Which is a joint pictures encoding group or something, if my memory serves me.
Something like that, Kerry, because it's got something to do with the people who come up with the standard.
Okay, the next one is .ppt, not one that you see, well, not one that blind people usually use a lot, but...
PowerPoint presentation.
That's correct, yeah, PowerPoint. Okay, and the last one we do see a lot. Okay, next one is .zip.
Compression.
Compacted.
Compressed. Yeah, compression, that's right, compression format.
Yeah, that you can actually get away with saying zip file for that one. No, it's actually a zip file. The format was actually created in 1991 by Phil Katz, who was sued by System Enhancements Associates for writing a program that was better than System Enhancements Archiver. So they came up with zip, so that is a zip file.
Okay, your directory structure has a set of attributes for each file. And those attributes determine how that file can be viewed or whether it can be altered. Okay, so I'm going to just see how much we all know here too. If I had a file that had just an R, that would mean that file is read-only. Okay. If you had A, the file will be archived the next time that the disk is backed up. If you had S, anyone tell me what that would mean?
That is a system file.
System file, that's right. And you'd get a warning if you wanted to delete it or modify that file. Sort of comes up with a little, oops, are you sure you want to do this? Okay. And the last one is H.
Yes.
And that's pretty obvious, I think, but let's see. Anyone know what H would mean?
Hidden.
Hidden, yeah, that's right. Okay. So it spells the word rash. Read, archived, system, and hidden. Okay. Okay, you can actually look at your extensions and attributes by using your DOS window and using the attrib, A-T-T-R-I-B command. And you do that by start, run, and then typing in CMD. You can also navigate to the folder that contains the file that you're interested in. Type in the attrib.
Why not properties? Because you'd need to know how to use the JAWS cursor. And usually when your system has crashed so hard that you're looking at attributes, the only thing you've got left to you is a DOS prompt. So it's very important to know how to do it with a DOS prompt, because if those attributes are wrong and your system's down in a heap, you'll be at the recovery console bringing it back to life.
If you want to look at a number of files, you can use what we call a wildcard, which is *.*. And that lets you look at a number of files all at once, and you'll find that the attributes of each file will be in the left-hand column of the screen, and information about your attrib command can be found at the command prompt. And you can type in, like a lot of these type DOS commands, if you're using a question mark after them. So if you had wanted to find out more about that command, you could go attrib, attrib, then you would have /, and a question mark. And you can, as you say, you can actually right-click a file using Explorer as well, another way, and choose properties from the box that will appear. So you'd go, if you wanted to see the properties of file using that, you would have to set Windows Explorer to show hidden files, and you'd right-click on the start or use the start menu, explore, then tools, I think it's folder option, and then view to do that. Now, we talked a little bit earlier in the lecture about NTFS and FAT32. Okay. I know some people gave me what NTFS means. Can someone else give me a definition, please? NTFS, what does it stand for?
NTFS or FAT, are they?
Sorry, what was that, Elise?
What was the question again, sorry?
Yeah, could you just, tell me what it stands for, and somebody's given it.
NTFS on Logi File System.
That's right. Like I said, I'm going over these things and putting them right into your brains. There's someone sitting next to me here saying, oh, I've forgotten.
It was the NT file system or New Technologies.
New Technology file
system. Or Neanderthal technology, if you have the opinion of NT that a lot of people do. But we won't accept Neanderthal technology as a correct answer in the test.
And also, can anyone tell me, I'm going to go back over this too, what FAT stands for? Now, don't be rude.
File allocation table.
That's correct, yep. Okay.
File allocation system.
File allocation table, that's right, yeah. Okay, so XP and also Windows 2.
File allocation system, file allocation table.
That's right. Okay, Windows XP and 2000 both use FAT32 and NTFS file systems, and your difference between them, NTFS provides more security, and it can support larger files than does FAT32. So it's a more flexible security feature for your files and folders. You can have partitions that are converted from FAT32 to NTFS, and you would use the convert.exe utility to do that, and you would get the added advantages of NTFS. If you wanted to go back the other way to restore an NTFS partition back to a FAT32 partition, you'd have to reformat your partition, and restore your data from a backup.
Can anyone tell me why you can't convert back the other way? The reason you can't go back from NTFS to FAT32 is because the conversion of NTFS to FAT32 will destroy all partition information and render every file readable by every account.
Why not use partition magic?
Why not use partition magic? Because it costs money and it's no longer supported.
Okay, so I think the main thing there is before you try and convert a file system, remember to back up your data. Okay, back up. Okay, if you've got a network server that uses NTFS file system, you can define a special, and I'm only going to touch on this, access control list. Because I know Kerry's going to go a lot more into that in CCNA, aren't you, Kerry?
They're different access control lists, but yes, we will be talking about those in CCNA.
But you will be talking more about them, yeah.
Yeah.
You have a copy of the file that is cached on your client computer, and that retains your access control list settings. And that's only if the system drive of the client computer also uses NTFS. If your system drive of your client computer is formatted using FAT or FAT32 file system, you'll find that the access control list settings aren't maintained for that locally cached copy of the file. And basically that means that other people who are using the computers may not be able to access that file. They won't also be able to synchronise any changes to your network share version of the file if they don't have the appropriate access permissions. To keep a high level of network security, we would suggest that you format or convert the drives of all the client computers that are running, say, Windows 2000 Professional or using your or XP using the NTFS file system. And as I mentioned, we'll be talking more about the access control lists as we move along through ITE and also in CCNA. And again, I'm going to mention... Don't forget to back up your data. Yes, Dean?
I've actually got a good document on file systems if you want me to post it for the class.
That sounds good to me.
Don't post it. We don't want to be... Every time you post a document out to the mailing list, Dean, it reflects out to be 80 copies. So if you send it to the instructors, we will put it on the website. We really wish to discourage people posting... Word documents and things through to the
No, that's okay, just letting you know
because we are seeing the mailing lists are getting bigger and bigger and we're sending out a lot of mail traffic, so if unless they're like little exercises and text files, we'll either post URLs to documents or if you send it to us, we'll stick it up on the QCAT site for people to fetch from there.
That's a great idea.
The instructors, because it's a very good document.
Okay, that'd be great. Then we can put that up on the website, which would be of benefit to everybody. That's great. Thank you, Dan. Okay, we talked a little bit about the graphical user interface, or the GUI, and that allows you to... It's an interface that allows you to interact with the computer, as does a command line interface. They're just... different ways of interacting with the computer. So with a GUI, it gives you a graphical representation, or we often mention or refer to them as icons, of the files and the folders and programs that you've got on your computer. And people can click on them with a mouse if they've got sight, or we can actually get onto them using a Start M to get to our desktop, and navigating with our arrow keys there. So the difference between them, one is graphical, your GUI, and your command line interface is text-based. In other words, you've got to type in the commands to allow you to manipulate
type
your
everything.
Files, that's right, or execute programs. Okay, you can customize your desktop. Anyone like to have a go at telling us how you would customize the desktop?
That desktop cleanup wizard thing to start with, arrange icons.
Change the wallpaper to something you like. Something you like.
Yeah, you can do all that.
I think the option she's after is right-click on empty desktop and start fiddling in the menus. And that's in your tests as well. And go properties or change those options through there.
And you get a number of... Sorry.
I was just to say, to actually right-click on empty desktop with JAWS, which is a little bit tricky to do, you actually have to cursor onto an icon, press spacebar to unselect it, and then hit the right mouse button.
You can customize things like your screensavers, the appearance, your font sizes, all your settings, and it's quite a good thing to do. Especially people with sight love to play around with all the settings and wallpapers and...
Start settings control panel display.
Yep, you can do it that way too. Yep. Okay. All right, and you can also go through things like if you want to look at the various drives that you've got on the computer, you can go through My Computer. That's on your desktop, or you can go through your Start menu. You would right-click on My Computer or enter on it and choose Properties, and you can customize things like the name of your computer. Call it Harry Houdini or whatever you like. You can also customize things like your hardware settings, the virtual memory, whether you want automatic updates, and we sort of don't suggest that, or remote access. So there's a number of things that you can customize through that. With regard to launching your applications, you can do that by either clicking the application that's on your Start menu, or you can double-click the application shortcut that you've got on the desktop, or double-click click the application executable file in My Computer, or you can go through the run window or the command line. If you wanted to think about the My Network Places, for example, you can go in and have a look at your network and what's happening there, and then you can...
Yes, you can also use the address bar, but the address bar is actually part of My Computer, so she has covered that one.
The file system document has been sent to the KD instructors.
Thank you, Dean. That's good. And you would click on the properties of My Network Places to look at your existing network connection, and you can then, when you get there, you can right click on, say you wanted to look at your local area network, you can go to that and right click on it, it'll bring up the properties of that network as well. You'll be doing a lot more of that actually practically as we go along as well. Okay, for your run commands, you'll find that Windows actually centralises the settings for a number of the features, and the run settings are characterised in applets, and an applet's just a small program that's found in Control Panel. You can go in and you can add or remove programs, change your network settings, change your security settings, and also some of your configuration options, and they're all available through Control Panel. As I mentioned, we often refer to as applets, and they will differ depending on the type of version that you've got of Windows. But in Windows XP, which we're talking about mainly today, you'll find there's settings like appearance and themes, and they look after things like your display or your taskbar and start menu, also your folder options. As I just touched on too, was the network and internet connections. And they can, those applets actually configure all the connection types, like your internet options or your network options. Another one you'll have there is add or remove programs. As it says, it tells you, it allows you to add programs or to remove programs. If you put something on your computer and you decide that you don't want it, you can go into the add or remove programs to do so. Sorry, someone was saying something? Okay. You also have applets for sound settings and speech and any of your audio devices, portable media devices. Yeah, all of those.
Yeah. Yeah, the people at Enable Indy, I think, look as though they're accidentally hitting their press-to-talk hotkey. So if you've got something to say, by all means, press that key. Otherwise, if not, try and avoid pressing that key if possible.
You'll also have applets for your performance and maintenance, and in that you'll have things like your administrative tools, power options, any of your scheduled tasks, and also an applet that takes you to the system itself. Printers and hardware, other hardware are there, things like your keyboard, mouse, you can go and have a look at all those settings, your user accounts. They're the applets that will let you configure options for your users, also for email and other user accounts. You can also look at the date and time. That's where you set all the date and time, the language of choice. Your region. There is also accessibility options that allows you to sort of customise Windows if you've got a vision problem, which we all have, or hearing, or you've got problems with, you know, mobility, you can't actually use the mouse in the traditional way, or that you can set them all using those applets. There's also a security setting there. That's where your Windows firewall is, where you have the options for the internet, and you also have the options for automatic updates. And there's also another one there with your display. And as I mentioned before, you can change, you play around with the way things display on the computer. You can look at things like changing the appearance of your desktop or changing the resolution, colour quality. Do fun things like changing your wallpaper or your screensaver. Also your power settings. Easy way to do that too is to go to Start, Control Panel, Display, your settings tab, and then advanced. We did talk about your device manager earlier, and I'm going to just expand a little bit on what I said earlier. The device manager allows you to view all of the settings for the devices on your computer, and you'll find that you're using the device manager quite a lot. As a technician, you're going to have common tasks of viewing various things like the IRQ, IO addresses, and your DMA settings for all of your devices, and also your system resources. Again, you would go Start, Control Panel, System, Hardware, Device Manager, View Resources, or as Kerry mentioned before, quick way to do it is to go Start, Run, DEV, MGMT, taking you into your device manager in a quick way.
I think you forgot the .msc bit, but that's okay.
Oh, sorry, yes. .msc. I got it this time. Okay. Your task manager, that's will allow you to view all the applications actually running at the time. It'll also let you close any applications. I'll try and say that again.
That stands for .msc.
Oh, okay, yeah. MSC. Yeah, thank you. .msc is Microsoft, that's right. Okay, your task manager, as I said, is going to allow you to view currently running applications. And if you've got, go into that too, sometimes you go there for things that have actually stopped responding, you know, that aren't working any longer. So it allows you to monitor the performance of the CPU and all the virtual memory. And it'll tell you all about things that are currently running. And if you wanted to view information there, you could use Control-Alt-Delete and then Task Manager. You also have an event viewer, and that gives you a log of a history of the events regarding all the applications, also the security on the system. And those log files will help you with troubleshooting. And to get into your event viewer, you would use Start, Control Panel, Administrative Tools, and then select Event Viewer. Your remote desktop is the function that allows one computer to remotely, hence remote desktop, take control of another computer. And it's only available with Windows Professional, XP Professional. Sorry?
It is not JAWS or WindowEyes accessible. System Access have made their own, but the remote desktop is not screen reader accessible, so you'll need iPad.
I need to correct you there, Lisa. It actually is. You just don't have the authorization to do it.
Oh, that's not fair. I want the authorization to do it. I'm going to get it.
Yeah, it is actually possible to use remote desktop using a screen reader, but you do need to install the remote access client on the machine you wish to control and the remote access server on the one that's going to do the controlling. And yes, you can do it with WindowEyes, who don't charge you any extra for the privilege, and JAWS, who do charge you extra for the privilege.
Well, my apologies. I didn't know that.
That's okay.
Mine is...
All right.
Mine just goes complains and goes...
Yeah, I believe I had mine go, as well, as you so eloquently put it, and so as eloquence eloquently puts it. But yeah, it will work if you've got the correct authorization.
Okay, thank you. All right, so to get to your remote desktop, you'd go to your Start, then All Programs, Accessories, Communications, and then select Remote Desktop Connection. You can also do things like go into your performance settings, and they will help you to enhance the performance of your operating system, and they can actually change some of your settings there. For example, if you wanted to play around with the virtual memory setting, you'd again go Start, Control Panel, System. Then when you get in the system, you go Advanced, Performance Area, and Settings button. So there's all sorts of fun things you can play around with. And it's good to have a little play around, but be careful. Okay. Okay, so next thing I want to talk about was the add or remove programs. I did touch on those before. They are very... very useful if you put something in, as I mentioned, that you decide suddenly like that you don't want, or you've gone through and you've used a wizard and you've gone next, and suddenly you've got the Google toolbar. You can go in and remove it through your add or remove programs applet. And again, you would go Start, Control Panel, Add or Remove Programs. Sometimes you'll get a programs that you want to add that haven't been automatically installed when you've put in your CD. So you can then also use the add or remove programs to install that particular application. As you go through the wizard, it will say things like, do you wish to have a desktop icon? Do you wish to have a system tray icon there as well, so you can select yes or no. So do listen to the options that your wizard is giving you, and not do next. Did I learn something last year, Karen?
I think so. In fact, what happened was when Geraldine first started, and I'll embarrass her here for 5 seconds, she went next, and then she goes, it doesn't work. Then she would actually, we went back and we went, well, you're going to uninstall that, and this time we want this. The other thing to keep in mind, people, is when you're installing things, don't rely on JAWS to read you everything. Not all install shields will read with the will read automatically. Use your JAWS cursor if you are unsure of what's in the window, and that's very important. I want to write a little one that says, next, this program will erase your hard drive. Click next to continue, and see how many people actually hit the next button without actually reading the dialogue. I can't actually do that because that's not very nice, but it'd be interesting to see how many people got bitten by that.
It would be, wouldn't it? It's all right for me. I don't do that anymore. we don't mind embarrassing each other here. It's fine.
Hopefully I did not get the software.
Yes. All right. Sometimes you'll have an application that hasn't installed correctly or properly, and in that case, you may have to go and uninstall it, because otherwise you're using up unnecessary hard drive space and you've got unnecessary settings in your registry. As I said, the main thing is it's going to deplete your available hard drive space and your resources that you've got at hand. So you would then also use the add or remove programs. Slow. Yeah, that's right, it'll slow down. And you'd use it to uninstall the programs that you don't need any longer. And you'll also get a wizard there, and it will guide you through that process. Again, read your wizards, all right? She speaks from previous experience. Okay, sometimes you may wish to upgrade an operating system. One of the things that you'd have to look at there is to check the minimum requirements of your new operating system that you're wanting to install to make sure that your computer's specifications are okay. You would need to check your hardware compatibility list, or HCL, which we talked about, I think it was last week or the week before. Again, you would back up all your data. Because you need a point that you can go back to, and you know that your computer data is all backed up before you start playing around with it. And you know the you'll find that in XP the settings and files should still be there when you have upgraded, but it's a good idea to back up anyway.
Yeah, interesting question here, and we don't want you to answer this on chat. We just want you to think about this in your own minds. Who here actually has reasonable backups? If your hard drive fell over this afternoon, could you be up and running in 3 hours? Just have a think about that. You could buy Trevor. Who has adequate backups? You should not be relying on System Restore. Who's got real backups? Just think about that. How important is your data to you? That's the big question. And in business, that becomes a value in dollars. And you've got to consider that value in dollars and make sure you've got adequate backups. Otherwise, it is your job on the line in a lot of cases. So backup, 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 backup. I saw a quote once that said, I'd back up my hard drive, but I just can't find the reverse switch. But seriously, people?
Back up on a regular basis.
That's right, yeah, back up regularly. And, you know, having external drives is very, very handy. Okay, all right, we're just going to talk a little bit about preventative maintenance for your operating system. Anyone tell me some of the preventative maintenance type things you
can do? Can anyone tell you what preventative maintenance is? Yeah, what is preventative maintenance?
Oh, yeah.
It's maintenance you do to stop things from happening in the first place.
Preferably before they actually happen.
That's correct. And anybody got any examples of preventative maintenance?
Defrag, Gemma said. That's right. That's defragmenting the hard drive.
Can people tell me when you shouldn't do a defrag? This is an interesting one. Anybody tell me when you shouldn't do a defrag? Yes, if your hard drive is making marble in paint tin clicking noises, otherwise everybody's heard them, they'll go... that's the time you start panicking and wondering why you didn't have real backups. A lot of us have been there. You either start saying words that we would not say in a lecture, or you go to the pub and get very, very drunk. Once the hangover is lifted, you then figure out what data you have lost. But the time you should not do a defrag, I think Greg is sitting here going, yeah, I've been here. If you have errors on your file system, because a defrag will just make it that much worse. And Mr. Leg, he lost all his data because he was drunk and using his computer. So don't drink and hard drive. That's the moral of that one.
Everybody's clapping here, folks.
Who won't carry?
Only no hard drinking, just soft drinking, of course. Soft drinking, of
course. Well done.
Oh dear.
Any other sort of preventative maintenance, people?
Apart from not letting Sister drink in front of your computer.
Yep, I'll take scan disk as one. Yeah. Other sort of preventative maintenance?
Please tell us about processor type 2.
We don't talk about processor type
2. Virus scans, of course, is one of the major.
Yeah, virus scans sounds like a good idea.
Yep.
And virus definition and spyware updates.
Yep. Yes, yeah. There's a whole lot of things you can do as a form of preventative maintenance. Good idea, as Kerry said, and I said a number of times, back up your hard drive.
We are getting some noise due to echo. Can we
no, we can't. I'm sorry, Geraldine's microphone receives me. There's nothing I can do. You'll just have to listen to the recording back if it's a problem. I'm sorry, we'll fix it after lecture.
So, back up, schedule tasks, and create a maintenance plan. If you have a plan where you have scheduled in things, stick to that plan. Do your preventative maintenance. Make sure you're getting it. It's no good having a virus checker, for example, that hasn't got the updates there because something may slip through. So make sure that you are keeping things up to date. Okay, as I mentioned, planning. Keep your hard drive backed up and defrag when you need to. It's going to help. How do you make plan? Just, you can do that by just making yourself a note, you know, once a week or something that, check the virus scanner or make sure that, my spyware is up to date. Yeah, schedule it. That's right.
My parents-in-law, bless their cotton socks, do all of their virus updating and things on a Saturday. It's part of the Saturday morning ritual.
If you are doing preventative maintenance, don't forget to do things like clean your computer. Okay, when's the last time everyone cleaned their computer?
Yes.
All right, Kerry, get a life.
I tried.
Yeah, that's right. Most people say once they don't. So yeah, now keep your clean clear to clean. Dust is an enemy and things too. Keep them nice and clean and spick and span. Okay. All right. Just scrolling down to see what we've got to do. Okay. Also, we talked a little bit about, I know somebody mentioned ScanDisk earlier. What was that?
How do you clean in a dusty? That was covered in Module 1, Samuel. Compressed air.
There are several things you can use that are included with DOS and Windows that will help you maintain the computer's integrity. They are ScanDisk or CheckDisk, and we talked a little bit about a couple of these a while ago. It actually checks the integrity of the files and folders and scans your hard disk surface for physical errors. Now, that's a good thing to do at least once a month or whenever you've got your systems to shut down. Your defrag, we talked a little bit about that. When you have files that are increasing in size, some of the data is written to the next available space on the disk. So over a period of time, the data gets fragmented. And by fragmented, we just mean it's all sort of spread all over the place or all over the hard drive.
We've already answered that. Compressed air will take the stuff out of the computer. That's covered in Module 1. We really are using compressed air.
So when you do defrag, it gathers the non-contiguous data into one particular place, so it makes your files then run faster. You can get to defrag by going through your start menu, then your programs, accessories, system tools, and your defragmenter. As regards automatic updates, we did touch on those.
You can also go to your CMD prompt and type defrag. /C:.
You can, Lisa, however, that is a non-graphical version of defrag, and sighted people become very sad and disillusioned by not being able to see the blocks move around.
Well, they should get over this.
I know.
we talked about automatic updates earlier and the value of doing automatic or not doing automatic updates. Really, you need to be sort of making those decisions yourself. Kerry did touch on system restore a moment ago, and system restore, if you've got...
Actually, can we do an experiment here? Can you go and turn yourself off automatic, and I'll talk about system restore very briefly, just to see if the echo goes away, so I'll just...
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Yeah, it probably is. We're just going to... Gerald's dad's going to go and check the use and push to talk hotkey. We don't usually, because usually the person who's lecturing is on the Braille display, which is kind of nice. Okay, System Restore is a handy-dandy utility that is meant to save your bacon. Basically, whenever you install an unsigned driver or a new piece of software, or there's a system-generated checkpoint, it takes a snapshot of what key areas of the system look like. For example, file system, system registry, program settings, that sort of thing. And you can theoretically roll your computer back to a previous time. However, there are more advanced programs such as Go Back. I can't remember who sells Go Back now.
Norton
Go Back?
Yeah.
And there's Roxio something something that does it as well. But be aware with these programs that will wind your computer back a la Apple Time Machine, that certain software is incompatible with them. For you who don't know what Apple Time Machine is, ignore that remark, we don't cover it. I'm done. I'll let you turn your, or whatever you want to do there, because, yeah, turn your thing back on or whatever.
Oh, well, at least we know what it is now.
Sue's being naughty. She said it's really good when we can't hear Geraldine.
That's not very nice. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Very much so.
She hasn't even sung once today yet.
Yes, she has.
You missed it earlier.
Yes, she sang before the lecture started.
But I haven't sung during lecture, have I?
Right, this is all your fault, Kerry.
I have been very restrained today.
Thank God.
They are all picking on me here, folks. Someone here just failed their ITE. Or CCNA, I have friends.
What am I does anybody know what I'm... Yeah. Oh, different types of backups. There are a number of different types of backups that I'll be talking about while Geraldine sorts things out. There is full, incremental, and differential. Yes, that one, Gemma. Full, incremental, and differential. A full backup is where you back up everything on the hard drive. That's why it's called full. Now, I've got to make sure I get these right. A differential backup is where you back up the differences since the last backup. Since the last full backup, that's correct. And an incremental backup is where you have to restore the full followed by all the incrementals you've taken since the last full, if that sounds correct. No? That's a differential. Oh, differential's when we've got to restore all the differentials. That's right. Okay, so I'll just summarise that. If you're doing a full backup and you've got a differential backup, you can restore the full and the differential backup. That'll get you to where you were. Is that right? And if you're doing the incremental, you've got to restore all the incrementals after you've restored the full backup.
Good on you, Kevin.
And Chris gave me all of that information. Chris Legg, who's sitting right next to me, very noisily gave me all that information. The fact is that usually we don't remember what full incremental and differential are, and we look it up in the help file of our backup software. Which one?
I can explain about the archive bit and all that.
Well, we won't explain about the archive bit. I do know how the archive bit works, but I don't think we cover that at the moment, so... refer to your notes, people, because they're going to be more accurate than we are. But there you have full incremental and differential backups, and it is in your test. So I had to know it about 2 years ago, so do look that up in your notes. Yeah, I know you're nodding. Okay. Full backup, you back up everything. Differential backup is where you back up everything since the last full backup. Difference. What's different? Incremental is where you back up the stuff that has changed since the last incremental. So here's an example. We do a full backup on Monday, an incremental on Tuesday, an incremental on Wednesday, an incremental on Thursday, an incremental on Friday. if our server crashes on
and never,
Thursday,
never on a Sunday, a Sunday, a Sunday, a Sunday afternoon.
Geraldine. Geraldine. I'm getting... I'm in trouble. Now I've said the wrong name. I'm done for. Now, so if your server crashes on Thursday, you have to restore the full backup. No, I'm giving the one for incremental. You restore the full backup on Monday. You then restore the incremental on Tuesday, the incremental on Wednesday, and the incremental on Thursday. Think increment.
But never on
never,
a Sunday.
Never on a Sunday, Sunday. Okay. Now, a differential backup is where you back up a full backup, and then you back up everything that has changed since that full backup. So you only need to restore one full and one differential. The reason you use incremental backups is it saves space on the backup media. Incrementals are usually smaller than differentials. If you are dealing with terabytes of data, you would probably be looking at incrementals.
And I've got Friday on my mind.
She's got Friday
Thank you,
on
Kerry.
Her mind, yeah.
Tell me why I don't like Monday.
Because Geraldine's singing in lecture. Yeah, is everybody cool with full and incremental and differential and
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you, Kerry. Now, I know you wouldn't like to miss out on this, so because we are at the end of the lecture, rather than me summarising and before we do the quiz, we will go to Mr. Kerry Hoth for his quick synopsis of today's module. Over to you, Kerry.
In Module 5, Part 2 today, we covered the following topics. The rest of the installation, various keys that you can press during the install that will allow you to select R4 Recovery Console, F3 to abort the installation, or Escape to skip the repair of an existing installation. We also covered System Restore, Backups, Full, Differential, Incremental. We also covered the NT boot sequence, the fact that NT Loader then loads Detect, which shows a hardware summary, which then loads various other things which you can refer to your notes about because I wasn't paying attention. The other thing that we covered was the registry, and there are 5 registry subkeys: H key local machine, H key current config, and I can't remember the other 3, so refer to your notes for those ones. Current control set, yeah, that's right. We also covered the ways of getting into the System Device Manager. We also covered the ways of pulling up the desktop properties, changing the folder options, a general overview of file attributes such as read-only, archive, system, and hidden. And that's essentially what we did in Module 5, Part 2.
Thank you, Kerry.
Somebody wanted to ask something?
We are finished Module 5, but we still have the quiz to go. So if you can hang around for the quiz. Next week we're going to do a bit of a revision of modules 1 to 5 before we move on so that people can try and catch up.
And Geraldine will be doing that. It will not be a 5-minute revision from me. It will be an extensive revision from Geraldine, so don't panic. With a song for each module.
With a song in my heart. I have a... Oh, thank you.
Oh,
I could carry on. Okay. Sue's just mentioned that if anyone is having problems...
Is there an exam for a module?
Yes, there is. There is an exam for every module except for Module 4.
Sue was just mentioning that if students are having trouble moving from the lobby into the lecture theatre, then she will move them, so don't panic. Okay? That's in the when you're setting up for your lectures. Okay, are we all ready for the quiz?
Yes, Miss Geraldine.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes, me.
Thank you, children.
Nice boys.
Oh, who said that? Ibrahim, I love you.
Poking me.
Okay. Okay, question 1. Which open source operating system is available on multiple hardware
platforms?
Is it A, Linux, B, Mac OS X, C, Windows 2000, or D, Windows XP?
Yeah, it's Linux.
A and B, actually.
No, OS X is not open source.
Oh, I missed the open source bit.
That's all right. We'll, I don't know, we'll give you 5 seconds detention or something.
It's Linux.
Yeah, radio.
Okay, question two. Which registry file contains information about the hardware and software in your computer system? Is it hkey_classes_root, bhkey_current_user, or hkey_local_machine, they're all _2, or hkey_users?
B.
C is the answer.
Yep. That was the hkey_local_machine.
It is referred to as HKLM in shorthand for hkey_local_machine.
You'd think it'd
be... question... Sorry, Lisa?
I'm just saying you'd think it would be user-associated rather than machine-associated.
No, it's the hardware and software on your local machine. That was the key of the question, on your local computer. Hardware and software that is specific to the computer, not specific to the individual user logins. Because the device driver instance is actually specific to the computer that it runs on.
Okay,
question four. How can the command line be accessed? Thank you. How can the command line be accessed in Windows XP?
Start, run, CMD.
That was correct. That was option B. That was option B. Start, run, command. Question five.
Windows R's and CMD if you're not running an IBM ThinkPad that doesn't have a Windows key.
Or Control Escape R if you're running a ThinkPad that doesn't have a Windows key.
Okay, these are multiple choice. So please put your options A to E or that's all right. into the chat box. Okay, question whatever I can't remember. I think it's six. Whichever, thank you. Which file system is recommended for Windows XP for large file support and enhanced security? Is it A, DirectX, B, DOS, C, FAT32, D, HPFS, or E, NTFS?
E.
Okay, now people, please don't answer early or you give other students an advantage. That's why we want you to put the letter in, not just type it in. That's okay. You'll just have to talk when it comes up. That's right. We know Lisa's not in the chat. We can talk. She can say hers when. Yeah, but she's got voiceover, and voiceover's evil with the Ventrilo chat.
Okay, yes, the correct answer was NTFS, which was option E. Question six. What is the purpose of the Microsoft hardware compatibility list?
To make your life difficult.
It lists all the hardware that runs Microsoft Office software, brought to you by Microsoft. B, it lists the Microsoft software that runs on the listed hardware. C, it lists hardware that is supported by a Microsoft operating system. Or D, it lists hardware that works together.
The question was, what does the hardware compatibility list, or HCL, do? And the answer, as everybody's typed into the chat, was C. It lists the hardware that is compatible with a specific Microsoft operating system. Microsoft is not the only person that maintains HCLs. Red Hat has them, Caldera has them, and quite a number of people have hardware compatibility lists, but they are certainly a Microsoftism.
Okay, question seven. What should be done before upgrading from Windows 2000 to Windows XP? A, back up all the data files. B, update the device drivers. C, detach all peripheral devices. Or D, download a legitimate XP authentication key. Go now.
Do you have E for take a Panadol?
Yeah.
I was going to say have a quick shower.
Have a glass or seven of wine.
I like that answer.
Which is ironic because the emulator that runs Windows applications under Linux is indeed called Wine.
Okay, and your correct answer was A, back up all the data files. Okay. Okie dokie. Question 8. Which key sequence will enable a user to start Windows XP in safe mode? Is it A, Alt plus B, B, Alt plus X, C, Alt plus Z, D, F1, or E, F8? Go now.
What the heck? I'm still on here, but I don't... Sorry, people. I'm still on here, but my sound has just gone to hell. So I don't hear anybody, if people can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, next question. What is the common cause of the error message? Invalid... Oh, yes, I didn't give you the answer the last one, did I? Yes, it was F8. The E, I think it was. I've moved on. Okay. Okay, I'll read the last question again.
Well done, people.
What is the common cause of the error message invalid system disk? A, the delete key was pressed during the system boot. B, there is a non-bootable floppy disk or CD in the drive. C, there is no floppy disk or CD in the drive. Or D, the BIOS has been changed to boot from the hard drive first. Go now. The correct answer was B, and most of you got that. There is a non-bootable floppy disk or CD in the drive. Which brings us to the end of the quiz.
An announcement, actually, just while I remember.
Yes.
We are currently working on putting the answers for the module exams up on the server, and there will be emails to the list later on today when those are available. There will be a special password that you will type in as a URL to fetch the answers for each exams, and we would really prefer that you did not share all the answers around. That's fine, because if you do and you will know what the answers are to the module tests, you'll fail the final exam anyway. So please don't hand the answers around if you can help it, or only provide them to students who have actually sat the exams to be able to listen to what the answers were, because you're only just hurting yourselves. So that will be up later today, and you'll be able to see what the answers to the questions were.